It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As part of the federal Stimulus CARES Act, the Department of Agriculture partnered with farmers, food distributors, and nonprofits to get fresh food to Americans who are food insecure during this pandemic and recession. It's known as the Farmers to Families Food Box Program. But now the Trump administration is insisting that a little something extra be included in that box. Dennis McManus is the Government Affairs Director for the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you, Kevin.
Dennis, your organization participates in the Farmers to Families Food Box program. It's a $4 billion program that redirects food that farmers would have sold to restaurants which were closed or had their operations limited due to the pandemic. Instead, that food goes to families in need. To clarify, the food bank purchases and distributes these boxes, but do you put them together?
We don't put them together. The vendors, and this is true across the country, are typically the ones that do the packing of the food and insert whatever they're required to insert in the boxes. We get the boxes sealed.
So how are you approaching these letters since you get the boxes sealed?
Well, we took a look at the letter. First of all, as we've just discussed, we're not required to place it in the box ourselves. Secondly, the letter is from the president in his official capacity as a federal official, and it's clearly not paid for by any political campaign. The food bank is a 501c3 organization, is prohibited from doing anything that it can even be perceived as supporting or opposing a candidate or a political party. And we take that obligation very seriously and scrupulously avoid any kind of engagement. It's on the White House stationery and not on, Trump or Pence campaign stationery. The letter was inserted under the terms of an agreement with another federal agency, USDA. Under these circumstances, we were fairly confident that taking no action, in other words, leaving the letters in the box, was the proper course of action and would not endanger our tax-exempt status.
The Washington Post is reporting that some food banks are removing the letters from the food boxes. From what you said, I assume you are not.
We are not. And there's a practical reason for that as well. The food bank doesn't think we should direct staff and volunteers to expend their valuable time and energy, not distributing food, but taking the time to take the sealed boxes of food, unsealing the boxes, removing the letter, resealing the boxes. It just doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, we wish that whatever was inserted in the boxes was edible, but in this case, it makes sense to us not to go to that extra, several steps.
In your time working with food security, have you ever heard of an administration mandating a letter from the White House on White House stationery be included in any food distribution?
Absolutely not. I've been, with the food bank for over 15 years now, and this is the first time that we've been confronted with this sort of a situation.
Anybody in your organization expressed concern about these mandated letters? Have you heard anything from your clients?
Actually, we haven't heard from the clients, and that's another point I wanted to make in terms of our decision making, which does, as you point out, differ from what some other food banks have decided to do. We also think that the people we serve who are receiving these boxes and perhaps reading the letter are able to determine for themselves the value and purpose of the letter. And also, if you look at the letter, roughly half of it, probably a little more than half of it, if you're counting words or space on the page, is dedicated to providing some coronavirus avoidance guidelines.
You mentioned the coronavirus information, but it does not necessarily recommend you should wear a mask, though, I believe.
Yeah, that's the interesting wording. You're right about that. It says consider. So perhaps not how we would have worded the coronavirus advice, but some of it, practice good hygiene, wash your hands, feel sick, stay home, protect the vulnerable.
Nonprofits are supposed to remain apolitical. Why do you think that's critical?
I think it's critical because, number one, the dollars that are donated to charities such as ours, come from people of all political walks of life. When they
send funds to us, they expect us to be responsible stewards of those dollars. Additionally, food banks receive a substantial amount of governmental support in our activities, the, you know, Farm to Families boxes being an example of that. And clearly the money that's provided by the government is not meant to be used to oppose or support anybody within the government.
Food banks across the country told Politico that there are concerns distributing the boxes containing those letters would jeopardize their nonprofit status or even break election laws. Have you been in touch with your counterparts across the country? And you don't seem to have concerns that the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank would be violating those regulations.
We as with most of the larger food banks, about 200 plus in America, are members of Feeding America, which is the national food bank network. And their legal counsel advised all that there was no problem with merely letting the letters stay in the boxes, at least in terms of electioneering prohibitions. I think if these boxes were to come to us with, you know, Trump Pence 2020 stickers on them, we probably would be tearing them off the boxes. But this isn't that.
Dennis McManus is the Government Affairs Director for the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great being with you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A rare bird was found by researchers at the Powder Mill Nature Reserve in Westmoreland County. The rose-breasted grosbeak is a bilateral gynandromorph, meaning half male, half female. Annie Lindsay is the bird banding program manager at Powder Mill. Annie, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Annie, of course, what's it look like?
So this bird, on first glance, looks just like almost any other grosbeak. But if you look at it closely, the male half of this bird has a pink underwing, a pink wash on the breast, and then the wing has more black feathers. And then the female half of the bird is browner. The wing is browner. The underwing is yellow, and the breast is buffy.
Mm-hmm. Is this what researchers typically see in a bilateral gynandromorph?
Yes. So generally it is, you know, that there's that center line through the middle of the bird, and, you know, one side is male, one side is female.
Mm-hmm. Were you keeping an eye out for this or just accidentally spotted? How did you find it?
Yeah, so we caught that bird during our normal bird banding operation. So it was caught in our mist net, and one of our field techs extracted it and excitedly brought it back to the lab. We banded it and processed it, and then we took some photographs because it's definitely a very rare find.
Mm-hmm. And then after the banding and the processing and the photoing, now it's let go again?
Yeah, we released it, and I have a release video, which you can kind of tell the male and the female video as it's flying away.
Okay. So give us an idea, just how rare is it to find a bird like this one in general and at Powder Mill?
Okay, yeah, so at Powder Mill, we have almost 800,000 banding records in our almost 60-year history, and we have five of these individuals in our database. I think that the museum has a few more that are species where you can't tell male from female. And they were birds that were found dead somewhere, and they did the necropsy, and they were able to tell just from the gonads that half was male and half was female.
Mm-hmm. Your records, do you know when the first one was discovered at Powder Mill?
I don't know when the first one was. I do know when the previous two were. So the last one was a rose-breasted grosbeak that was September of 2005. And then before that was a eastern towhee in 2001. I believe it was fall 2001.
So the most recent one prior to this, 15 years ago. How long have you been at Powder Mill?
In this position, about a year and a half.
And overall?
About 20 years, 21 years.
So I got to ask you, is this one of the most exciting times for you in your time at Powder Mill?
I think, yeah, it was. We've had an exciting fall, and I was also here for the first rose-breasted grosbeak, so it wasn't a brand new thing. It was really exciting to watch the crew's reaction to this bird. I think that did it for me.
So it's old hat for you. This is the second time in 15 years.
I mean, this was a great thing, but yeah, it's not a first.
Do researchers know how gynandromorphy happens?
When the egg has some DNA, right? It needs to get rid of about half of its genetic material, and it puts this in something that's called a polar body, which is supposed to be expelled from the cell. If it doesn't get rid of that polar body and the egg is fertilized, so the polar body and the cell's nucleus are fertilized, that's gives rise to two different halves of an organism that each have their own genome.
Right. Now, you mentioned banding it and then releasing it. Does this type of bird, the grosbeak, does it have a far range that it goes, or do you expect it to stay in the confines of the Powder Mill Nature Reserve?
Yeah, so this one almost certainly was actively migrating. Rose-breasted grosbeaks breed here, but they also breed further north of us. And then they go to southern Mexico, Central America, or northern South America. And some of them, I think, spend the winter in the Caribbean, like maybe Cuba and islands like that. So this bird has quite a journey ahead of it.
Mm-hmm. So you might not see it again? And if so, is that kind of sad?
Yeah, we probably won't see it again. You know, from time to time, we do catch birds, likely birds that breed close by during migration year after year. But generally, the birds that we see year after year are birds that are breeding here or spend the winter here.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned breeding. Is this bird capable of producing offspring?
Maybe. The left ovary in birds is the functional ovary. And so because this bird, the female side is the left side, she may have a functional ovary. But this depends also on the bird's behavior. If the bird behaves like a female and is able to attract a mate, it's possible that an egg could be produced and fertilized. However, if the bird behaves like a male and sings, it may be trying to attract females and elicit a territorial response in males.
Annie Lindsay is the bird banding program manager at Powder Mill Nature Reserve in Westmoreland County. Congratulations and thanks for your time.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Black Lives Matter movement spread more widely this year than any other protest in U.S. history. That included into some deeply conservative areas, including Franklin County in South Central Pennsylvania. Keystone Crossroads' Laura Benshoff reports that the movement has elevated fault lines and fractured alliances, even in solidly Trump-voting areas.
Linda and Marvin Worthy have been fighting for racial justice in Chambersburg, the seat of Franklin County, for several years. They work with local leaders in government, business, and education to address the entrenched racism they see in the community. When Black Lives Matter protests kicked off in the town square earlier this year, the Worthies, who are Black, were surprised and inspired to see so many young people and white people turning out for the cause.
To start seeing that organic movement happen in this small, very red county was phenomenal.
There are many people who are involved in work that we're doing that we don't know what their affiliation is, but we know that people are showing up we've never seen before.
That's noteworthy because Franklin County gets painted as a pretty homogenous place. Registered Republicans outnumber Democrats 2-1, and President Donald Trump won here with 72% of the vote in 2016. But there's evidence that this protest movement, aimed at highlighting the disproportionate violence Black Americans suffer at the hands of police, has a bigger following here than previously realized.
I happen to be a Republican. I certainly support Black Lives Matter.
Rodney Shoup is a 74-year-old retired Air Force pilot. Support among white Republicans for the Black Lives Matter movement jumped from 16 to 30% in the last few years, according to the Pew Research Center. Shoup says he was an original supporter of the movement.
I wish our country would have made a lot more progress since the Civil Rights Act of the 60s. We have made some, but not nearly enough.
Shoup voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and supports Joe Biden, who he believes will help unite the country. Franklin County District Attorney Matt Fogel is also a registered Republican. He's become the most visible conservative voice supporting the Black Lives Matter movement locally. Fogel says he saw the protests as an opportunity.
There's always like this rush to an opposite talking point. So it's like, well, let's talk about race. Like, don't presume law enforcement is on the other side of this reckoning. Like, let's get into this conversation.
He wrote a letter in support of the peaceful protests happening in downtown Chambersburg and the aims of the movement generally. For this, Fogel was cast out by the local Republican Party. They met with him privately and then publicly censured him. Dwight Weidman is a member of the Franklin County GOP Executive Committee.
He has run for 10 years on being a conservative Republican, and he just showed that, you know, he had deceived a lot of people.
He's also confident his party will repeat the blowout they had in the last election. Since 2016, voter registration rolls for Republicans in the county have grown by 4,000 people. For Democrats, the number went down by 700. Weidman says he can see the enthusiasm at the GOP headquarters.
There's a constant flow of people in all day, donating, getting signs, getting literature, getting bumper stickers, and asking to volunteer.
Research shows that protests can make a difference at the ballot. They can boost fundraising for groups on both sides of an issue, though more for the party aligned with the cause of the protests. And they can spur voter turnout. Pastor Lois Waters, who's lived on and off in Franklin County her whole life, is a Democrat who usually keeps her politics quiet. She says this year, it just feels different, in part due to the local protests.
I was really impressed because it's, you know, it's driven by young people. And so I'm just really amazed, and I'm really very proud and very encouraged and empowered.
She and her husband, Donald Waters, run Unity in Christ Church, a non-denominational congregation. Waters says she felt moved for the first time to put out a lawn sign in support of Joe Biden.
That was just my way of expressing, this is my support, this is what I believe.
Then two things happened.
I got a note in my mailbox, and it began, thank you for bravely posting the sign. That means that there is hope.
Later, someone stole her Biden-Harris sign. So she put up another one. Laura Benchoff, Keystone Crossroads.
This story is part of the America Amplified Initiative, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.